about controversy.
Meeting of the Clinton Township Board of Education will please come to order. In accordance with the provision of the New Jersey Open Public Meetings Act, Chapter 231, laws of 1975, adequate notice of this meeting was provided for this special meeting on August 6, 2012. Will you please have the roll call?
Mrs. Cresti?
Here.
Mr. Frida?
Present.
Mrs. Grant?
Here.
Mr. Malloy?
Here.
Mr. McTiernan?
Present.
Mrs. McLaughlin?
Here.
Mr. Sturgis?
Here.
Mrs. Sullivan? And Mr. Dinkoff?
Here. I'd like to ask everybody to please stand for the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
I do express my appreciation and thanks to all the board members for coming out on a summer evening in the middle of August. Not a regularly scheduled board meeting, but we do have important business that we have to attend to. As was indicated in the email that I sent out, I'm hoping that this evening we can continue the work we started on core values and talk some more about them and try to establish what those core values are going to be and how they're going to be implemented by the board during the 2012-2013 school year. In addition to the core values, we want to spend a little bit of time talking about goals for the 12-13 school year. You do have a copy in front of you of the board's self-evaluation. It was completed, at this point in time, completed by six members of the current board. I had indicated to Dan not to bother because he wasn't serving on the board during the 11-12 school year. But if you have not completed, and we still have two board members who have not completed the self-evaluation, there still is time to do that. But we would like to spend time this evening, if at all possible, working on goals for 12-13. Finally, it's my pleasure to be able to reintroduce to the board Pam Fyander, who spent some time with us a couple months ago. And I thought, the feedback that I received from the board was that we all thought it was a very worthwhile evening, or day. I guess we spent a Saturday together. And the board members wanted to see Pam come back and to share with us and help guide us through a better understanding of core values and establishing goals for the forthcoming school year. So, Pam, I'm going to turn the meeting over to you then.
Great, thank you. It's really nice to be back there. I can't believe I only live 20.23 miles from here. I set the odometer, so you're just my neighbors. I'd like you to take a minute and on a piece of paper, I want you to write the three things that you must do in your work to be successful. The top three skills you must use in your work to be successful. What you do every day. There are probably a whole bunch more than three that I'm making for stress.
We have to prioritize.
having spent my vacation at a conference on innovation in Los Gatos, California. If you've not been there, go. It's beautiful, it's very dog friendly. Every restaurant, and I love dogs, has a place that I didn't take mine. And everybody's so laid back because it's California and they're happy. But we were spending time with some of the independent school leaders and some of the innovators in the Silicon Valley. So I get to bring some of the things they shared with us and our work that we're going to do together. And I don't know, California's it's just pretty laid back. Now I'm in the rush and school has to start, but I think it's time to pause and think about that. So just set your three things, and you can change them if you want as we go along, but just be thinking what it is that's important in your work that makes you successful. I wanted to remind us of the mission statement, this mission statement of the Clinton Township Schools, because I am a firm believer that what we do personally, as an organization, professionally, is typically mission-driven. Sometimes it's articulated, sometimes it's not. It's a very powerful exercise. If you've never written a personal mission, I recommend you try that one. So the Clinton Township School District, in partnership with the community, achieves excellence for each child by ensuring a meaningful and challenging educational experience in a supportive environment, developing lifelong learners who are responsible and productive citizens. How well do we do this?
Pretty well. Challenges. Nobody's perfect, but I think pretty well we're doing for improvement.
What would you say you're the best at in terms of if you were to sequence that apart?
Well, I've not been on the board as long as some, so opinions will vary, but I think that since I've been on my interaction with the district has been, especially as a parent, I think we do have a meaningful and challenging educational experience, and I definitely think we have a supportive environment. Mm-hmm. In terms of lifelong learners and responsible productive citizens, I'll let you know when the kids are done.
Okay. Fair enough. So you think that this really is a foundation for the work that's done in the school district? It serves as a...
I absolutely think that that's
fantastic.
Yes.
That's great. Echoing? Yes.
I think that's a good mission statement, but I disagree slightly with what Kevin said on the supportive environment. But I state that on a reading that I did this morning on Yahoo.com, on the 10 worst jobs there are in the United States. And I think number 4 or number 5 is teacher. So while I think we're here to create and we're doing our best to create a supportive environment, it's clear that teachers across the country don't feel that. So I think we have our work cut out for us to make sure that the teachers in Clinton Township School District have that feeling, and anywhere else in the country.
Fair point. I was thinking more, it's a great point, but I was actually thinking about the supportive environment of the students. But your point is very well taken.
So I'm hearing yes. Mission statement, we agree, we're not, this is it, this undergirds our work. Great. You also have belief statements on your website. I lifted them. You say you believe that children come first, that there's a rigorous and challenging education will help every child become a productive member, that effective education prepares children to participate as socially responsible members of the world community, which if you go back in the history of school, that's why they created schools. Socially responsible members, that each child can learn, you believe in lifelong learning for all community members, and that technology will certainly enhance educational opportunities and productivity. In fact, do you believe this, collectively and individually? You can argue with me, it's okay. Yeah. So when I was last here, which I think was in May, we spent a Saturday together, and we talked about Board of Education core values, and I don't think you were with us, but I'll give you a wrap up.
Okay. Good, yeah.
So we went through an exercise where we looked at even an ethics study of how people behave, how they create ways that they decide they would organize themselves, how they would behave, and how they would police that. And so what this board did, and we, I believe this lady was really good. She got on the internet and helped us find some already developed core values that we sort of. It's called case principles, copy and steal effectively. Yes, so these are the core values that we talked about as a principled body operating together. We would, in terms of excellence, we would set high Board of Education goals and hold ourselves accountable for attainment. We would seek continuous improvement in all that we do. We'd take pride in achieving established goals, and we would celebrate our successes. I think words tend not to stop and pause and say, wow, we did something. We just keep satisfied. But as a military, we should consolidate our gaze and stop and say, wow, look what we've done. And now let's go. Dedicate ourselves to meeting the needs of our children, staff, and community. I heard this over and over in your speech. You are all very dedicated to the children in this district. Respect. Agree to respect individual viewpoints, to listen carefully. We would treat everyone with courtesy, politeness, and kindness. There's a quote I have in my office that says, there are three things that are important in life. The first is to be kind. The second is to be kind. The third is to be kind. Practice the golden rule in thought, word, and deed, not disparage other individuals or their ideas, and honor final decisions of the board, meaning once a decision is made, it's all right to duke it out in talking and working through something, but you go out together saying, this is how we're moving forward. Integrity. To exemplify personal and organizational ethical behavior, we will do what is right, equitable, and honest. Take responsibility for our actions and decisions. Maintain confidentiality of information entrusted to us, which is so important. Keep commitments and hold true to agreements. You said as collaborators, you would work in a collaborative environment, which would be open, trusting, honest, timely in your communication. You would engage others in the decision-making process where appropriate, and acknowledge and appreciate diversity. Value and respect the contributions of all. In learning, you decided that as a board, you'd be dedicated to learning and growth. You will always keep the children first in decision-making. Engage yourselves in continuous growth and development. Value and reward creativity, innovation, and risk-taking. I want to pause for a second. One of the things that I just thought it was fascinating, the big movement today is to teach kids how to fail. Have you heard that? I mean, it is sweeping the country.
How to what?
Fail. We have to teach children how to fail so that they understand resilience, they understand how to pick up and carry on, and they have to understand what those elements are and that they aren't failure as people. They perhaps failed at a task. Now, being the wise guy that I was, I wrote in my feedback, what if we fail at doing that? Anyway. but it's really a challenging thing to do. So risk-taking, creating an environment for each other, for the school district, that you may fail. And what's that going to feel like, and how do you handle that? But without that culture, you're not going to see a lot of risk.
There's also a lot of literature that supports that most successful business leaders have had significant failures in their careers. And their biggest learning has been recovering from that failure or adapting to make that failure a success in some way, shape, or form.
I'm so glad you brought that up, because one of the exercises I'm going to send you home with, and this will humble you like nobody's business, I double dog dare you to write your failure resume. Personal and professional. Double dog dare you. It comes out of a book. I was just, are you Kevin? Or do we have two Kevin?
Kevin.
We were talking about a book I recommend in Fierce Conversations. The book I recommend you today is What I Wished I Knew When I Was 20.
Oh, yeah.
It is fabulous. And she says, write your failure resume. And it's humbling, but it also helps you to understand, again, how you can take something you didn't achieve or you didn't do well, both personally and professionally, and you can turn it and see what you learned from it. So I'm excited about the thought of that we would celebrate, I didn't do it, because you know what, we all failed. Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you, it'll bring you to tears if you do it late at night, so do it in the morning. And to maybe like Jackson Brown, he came to me late in life, the singer. There's a song, he says, don't confront me with my failures, I have not forgotten. Ooh. So, I double dog ready to do that. We talked about setting goals and using data to evaluate the goal attainment. Do you say data or data here?
Yes.
Okay. I was 14 years in Oklahoma, and I said data, but everybody around here says data, so I'm trying to get data. So you're looking at information just as you did a self-study, and you look at that information to help establish goals. Value and support the learning of each child. That was your core value in learning. Flexibility. Demonstrate our personal and group flexibility. We will be open to new ideas. We will adapt to changing conditions in our schools and community. We will evaluate well-considered risks. There's that risk and risk-taking. And we'll embrace best new practices in our programs and efforts. Wow, that's a lot. How are you feeling about that? You've had a couple of months to think about it. you feel about it, and we kind of put it together and lifted it from that great website that you found. We have our notes too.
Sounds good.
Sounds good?
I think it, you know, originally when we constructed this list, it was, I think everybody felt very good about the list, but then after it sat for 6, 8 weeks, 10 weeks, you go back and you're like, oh, we wrote this. It's pretty good.
Yeah, so this is a time, let's pause and celebrate. It really was good work. It really is. And you tailored it, and you weren't here yet, but they were eagerly awaiting your arrival, that this was important work as an organization to do. So you're still feeling okay. Jim, how are you feeling?
Feeling okay.
Is there anything you wanted to take out, add in?
I especially like that part about failure, learning from failure. One of the things that I've noticed, and this is especially true, I think, in sports that younger children participate in, everybody ends up getting a trophy.
Yeah.
Everybody ends up, you know, being on an all-star team kind of a thing. And I think it's important for children to learn how to accept failure and how, you know, things always don't come out the way they would like them to come out, or their team doesn't always end up in first place, or they don't always get a trophy for participating in a sport or athletics. I think there's an awful lot that can be learned from our mistakes.
So how have you failed as a board?
How have we failed as a board?
Have you ever failed as a board? And how did you do that, and how did that feel? And what did you do about? How's that for a five-part question?
Good question.
Pardon me?
I said that's a good question. I've been here long enough that sort of meeting.
Have you ever considered that you have in some way failed as a board or failed as a task as a board? Let's put it not as a. And if you have, how did that feel? And then what did you do? Let's talk about failure.
I think we failed more frequently.
Mm-hmm.
In several ways. I think if you read these self-evaluations when I was doing it, it was sort of my own personal failure resume. I think that if you want to talk technically, I think at times we fail to hit deadlines. I think we fail to, be perfectly honest, here's one. I think this board failed to look at what we accomplished in May and start acting on it right away. That's a failure in and of itself. I think we have to date, at least in the last 10 months, I think we failed to effectively communicate on a lot of different topics and a lot of different issues. Now, I think we're addressing those failures, and I think we're working towards remedying those failures. I think that we've recently, within the last several months, and I'm going to give Dr. Clark a fair amount of credit in some of the committee meetings that we've had, we've been able to look our shortcomings in the eye, move past them, and start to figure out how to change them. Every school board's going to fail. Continually. I'm not saying we're a failure. I'm saying we continue. Little things. Some little things roll up, but I don't. Anybody want to comment, please do. But I think that we fail a little bit each day. Nobody has the perfect day. There's a TV show called 30 Rock. Have you ever watched it? Okay. Jack Donaghy, who's an unbelievable caricature, he refers to something called Reaganing, which is like having the perfect day. And he said, there are only three people who've ever Reagan, Lee Iacocca, and no judgment, Saddam Hussein, right? Where he said, only three people who ever had a perfect day.
Yeah.
It's a joke, but it's accurate. Nobody has a perfect day.
So what I'm going to say is you can take those and then turn them and work from them and try to improve.
Well, that's what we are doing, I think.
And many of you are athletes. You've been off the field because you were hurt.
A couple
is that what, isn't that what athletes do? I'm reading Coach Wood's book. I don't know anything about Coach Wood. Most winning basketball coaches and whatever, there was this great quote about him. There were so many. He's really, they said it, Coach Wooden had double vision. Mm-hmm. He had a microscope in one eye and a telescope in the other. Mm-hmm. And think about that as board members, being able to see and strategically plan at the same time, you know, nose in, hands off, what's going on. But when an athlete doesn't win or quote, fails, what do you do? Train?
I think you have to evaluate why you failed, what you did well, what you didn't do well, what your opponent did well that day, build a strategy for overcoming that, setting a game plan for why you failed. And then once you set the plan, then it's your responsibility to move forward and execute that plan.
It sounds like you're saying exactly what he's saying, the words you can do. Mm-hmm. You're just putting it in athletic terms. You're saying the same thing. Mm-hmm. Why did we do this? Okay, we did. What's our plan? Now we're responsible for doing that. Just as you did some amazing work, but I'm hearing you didn't turn around and say, are we holding ourselves to this? Just yet.
Except one thing in athletics that's not here on the board is that in athletics you tend to have an independent party called a coach. And that person is watching what you're doing, watching how you're performing, watching how the other team's performing, and comes back and has you modify what your behaviors are to somehow cover up your developmental areas or weaknesses and take advantage of your strengths. And here, when you're involved in a team, what tends to happen is you do groupthink, is you get so focused on what you're doing, you fail to look at what did we do well, what didn't we do well, and you're just caught up in the moment.
See, I think we're a coaching staff.
But I also think that really good athletes who take themselves from being an average athlete or a good athlete, what they do is say, there's two segments of what I do on a daily basis as I participate on this team. One is goals of the whole team and how we evaluate our performance as a whole team and how we as a team get there, and we're all little cogs in the wheel. But then you have to take responsibility for yourself and say, okay, what can I do better as an individual to make a contribution? And so whereas maybe we don't have, quote, a coach that gets paid millions of dollars, we're each responsible for saying what we did well, what we didn't do well, self-reflection, and then try to make sure that we provide the best positive performance, if you will, on what we do so that this whole team performs well.
Yeah, I mean, you've been watching the Olympics, and you can't help but, and I've never watched that much sports as I have, but the women's volleyball, and they set it up for that, I think, such a great metaphor. It may not be you making the slam, but you're setting it up for him. And you can do that as a board. I love your idea, though, about not having a coach, because somebody to have that, you know, stand back and watch, because you're in the middle playing the game, and that's probably what's difficult.
It's interesting, as I do some coaching, as I know other people here do too, and the younger the athletes are, the better they are at the sport in their mind. The more mature the athletes are at a professional level, the more they can dictate to you what their developmental areas are, what it is they have to work on in order to be better. So it's almost like you become more professional in what you do, you recognize your shortcomings. The less professional that you are, the less you recognize those shortcomings, because you don't have the knowledge base.
It's a great metaphor for how a board works, and it's a wonderful introduction. I hope this comes up. I saw this, and it reframed the way I thought about working as a group. And conflict. And I mean, it like appeared to me 2 days ago, and I said, I can't wait to bring this to you. So please hope that the YouTube plays.
Okay. Do we get popcorn with the movie?
Yeah. I do have gold stickers if you want. You think I'm kidding? I brought gold stickers. It is, it's going to wind up. This is so worth it.
She can put it next to the microphone or something.
Anna,
you know,
in Oxford in the 1950s, there was a fantastic doctor who was very unusual, named Alice Stewart. And Alice was unusual partly because, of course, she was a woman, which was pretty rare in the 1950s. And she was brilliant. She was one of the, at the time, the youngest fellow to be elected to the Royal College of Physicians. She was unusual, too, because she continued to work after she got married, after she had kids, and even after she got divorced and was a single parent, she continued her medical work. And she was unusual because she was really interested in a new science, the emerging field of epidemiology, the study of patterns in disease. But like every scientist, she appreciated that to make her mark, what she needed to do was find a hard problem and solve it. The hard problem that Alice chose was the rising incidence of childhood cancers. Most disease is correlated with poverty, but in the case of childhood cancers, the children who were dying seemed mostly to come from affluent families. So what, she wanted to know, could explain this anomaly? Now, Alice had trouble getting funding for her research. In the end, she got just £1,000 from the Lady Tata Memorial Prize. And that meant she knew she only had one shot at collecting her data. Now, she had no idea what to look for. This really was a needle in a haystack sort of search. So she asked everything she could think of. Had the children eaten boiled sweets? Had they consumed colored drinks? Did they eat fish and chips? Did they have indoor or outdoor plumbing? What time of life had they started school? And when her carbon-copied questionnaire started to come back, one thing and one thing only jumped out with a statistical clarity of a kind that most scientists can only dream of. By a rate of 2 to 1, the children who had died had had mothers who had been x-rayed when pregnant. Now that finding flew in the face of conventional wisdom. Conventional wisdom held that everything was safe up to a point, a threshold. It flew in the face of conventional wisdom, which was huge enthusiasm for the cool new technology of that age, which was the x-ray machine. And it flew in the face of doctors' idea of themselves, which was as people who helped patients, they didn't harm them. Nevertheless, Alice Stewart rushed to publish her preliminary findings in The Lancet in 1956. People got very excited. There was talk of the Nobel Prize. And Alice really was in a big hurry to try to study all the cases of childhood cancer she could find before they disappeared. In fact, she need not have hurried. It was fully 25 years before the British and American medical establishments abandoned the practice of x-raying pregnant women. The data was out there, it was open, it was freely available, but nobody wanted to know. A child a week was dying, but nothing changed. Openness alone can't drive change. So for 25 years, Alice Stewart had a very big fight on her hands. So how did she know that she was right? Well, she had a fantastic model for thinking. She worked with a statistician named George Neal, and George was pretty much everything that Alice wasn't. So Alice was very outgoing and sociable, and George was a recluse. Alice was very warm, very empathetic with her patients. George frankly preferred numbers to people. But he said this fantastic thing about their working relationship. He said, "My job is to prove Dr. Stewart wrong." He actively sought disconfirmation, different ways of looking at her models, at her statistics, different ways of crunching the data in order to disprove her. He saw his job as creating conflict around her theories, because it was only by not being able to prove that she was wrong that George could give Alice the confidence she needed to know that she was right. It's a fantastic model of collaboration. Thinking partners who aren't echo chambers. I wonder how many of us have or dare to have such collaborators. Alice and George were very good at conflict. They saw it as thinking. So what does that kind of constructive conflict require? Well, first of all, it requires that we find people who are very different from ourselves. That means we have to resist the neurobiological drive, which means that we really prefer people mostly like ourselves. And it means we have to seek out people with different backgrounds, different disciplines, different ways of thinking, and different experience, and find ways to engage with them. That requires a lot of patience and a lot of energy. And the more I've thought about this, the more I think, really, that that's a kind of love, because you simply won't commit that kind of energy and time if you don't really care. And it also means that we have to be prepared to change our minds. Alice's daughter told me that every time Alice went head to head with a fellow scientist, they made her think and think and think again. My mother, she said, my mother didn't enjoy a fight, but she was really good at them. So it's one thing to do that in a one-to-one relationship, but it strikes me that the biggest problems we face, many of the biggest disasters that we've experienced, mostly haven't come from individuals, they've come from organizations, some of them bigger than countries, many of them capable of affecting hundreds, thousands, even millions of lives. So how do organizations think? Well, for the most part, they don't. And that isn't because they don't want to. It's really because they can't. And they can't because the people inside of them are too afraid of conflict. In surveys of European and American executives, fully 85% of them acknowledged that they had issues or concerns at work that they were afraid to raise. Afraid of the conflict that that would provoke, afraid to get embroiled in arguments that they did not know how to manage and felt that they were bound to lose. 85% is a really big number. It means that organizations mostly can't do what George and Alice so triumphantly did. They can't think together. And it means that people like many of us who have run organizations and gone out of our way to try to find the very best people we can mostly fail to get the best out of them. So how do we develop the skills that we need? Because it does take skill and practice too. If we aren't going to be afraid of conflict, we have to see it as thinking, and then we have to get really good at it. So recently I worked with an executive named Joe, and Joe worked for a medical device company. And Joe was very worried about the device that he was working on. He thought that it was too complicated, and he thought that its complexity created margins of error that could really hurt people. He was afraid of doing damage to the patients he was trying to help. But when he looked around his organization, nobody else seemed to be at all worried. So he didn't really want to say anything. After all, maybe they knew something he didn't. Maybe he'd looked stupid. But he kept worrying about it. And he worried about it so much that he got to the point where he thought the only thing he could do was leave a job he loved. In the end, Joe and I found a way for him to raise his concerns. And what happened then is what almost always happens in this situation. It turned out everybody had exactly the same questions and doubts. So now Joe had allies. They could think together. And yes, there was a lot of conflict and debate and argument, but that allowed everyone around the table to be creative, to solve the problem, and to change the device. Joe was what a lot of people might think of as a whistleblower, except that like almost all whistleblowers, he wasn't a crank at all. He was passionately devoted to the organization and the higher purposes that that organization served. But he had been so afraid of conflict until finally he became more afraid of the silence. And when he dared to speak, he discovered much more inside himself and much more given the system than he had ever imagined. And his colleagues don't think of him as a crank. They think of him as a leader. So how do we have these conversations more easily and more often? Well, the University of Delft requires that its PhD students have to submit 5 statements that they're prepared to defend. It doesn't really matter what the statements are about. What matters is that the candidates are willing and able to stand up to authority. I think it's a fantastic system, but I think leaving it to PhD candidates is far too few people and way too late in life. I think we need to be teaching these skills to kids and adults at every stage of their development if we want to have thinking organizations and a thinking society. The fact is that most of the biggest catastrophes that we've witnessed rarely come from information that is secret or hidden. It comes from information that is freely available and out there, but that we are willfully blind to because we can't handle, don't want to handle, the conflict that it provokes. But when we dare to break that silence, or when we dare to see, and we create conflict, we enable ourselves and the people around us to do our very best thinking. Open information is fantastic. Open networks are essential. But the truth won't set us free until we develop the skills and the habit and the talent and the moral courage to use it. Openness isn't the end. It's the beginning.
Dealing with a lot of conflict versus avoidance of conflict.
Having a lot of conflict. How much do you have to deal with? 1 to 10.
7. 8.
6.
7.5, 8.
8, maybe 9.
Okay.
We'll go with 8.
That's a lot. Good. So if you buy what she said, I don't know about you, but I thought that was fascinating. There's this woman who knew something for 25 years. And I was born in 1956, and I'm sure my mother was
it's the story of the emperor has no clothes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Willfully blind. Openness alone can't drive change. Creating conflict. Find and purposely work with people who are different. And I love that conflict is thinking. It's thinking. It's messy. So if you take the idea, if you buy this, you may not buy this, if you buy that conflict is thinking, and that you range anywhere from, I heard, 6, 7, 8, 9, in terms of all that you have to do as an organization, you put that here, and then you put your values here. How do you merge those? How does that work? Will it work? Can the value formatting that you have help you to use conflict with general conflict with issues to think?
There's a book I'm actually reading called The Corner Office. I saw it in the New York Times. And it actually talks about executives, CEOs, who failed and how they dealt with their failures and moved forward and created teams. And one of the things that I was thinking of as I'm reading this book is the whole concept of creating a good working team begins with the basics of caring about each other and having some of the same values to move forward together. Not that you agree on everything, but that you're caring enough about the other people who are sitting at the table to listen to what they have to say and work it through in terms of conflict. And when I look at the list of values that the board put together, that seems to me to be the base of how we're going to behave as a group when we experience that conflict. So in eight, what you're really saying, though, is when we're saying an 8 or 9 as conflict, then we're a really good board, because that's a good thing for us to be.
Thank you.
No, but it's the type of disagreements that you have. If you're having a disagreement with conversation and discussion, that's positive, because if you have a core value statement that you all agree to, you can eventually get to a point where you come to consensus or compromise and agreement. If you have disagreement and all you're doing is throwing the ball over the fence, then you don't have common agreement on values, you don't have common purpose, therefore no one's going to compromise, and you're not going to get to a point where you can move ahead and be successful. So I think the point here would be is that we're open. Conflict is thinking, but it's thinking on how does my position versus another position drive us to the common good. I'm not sure I see all that here yet.
Somebody tell me what he just said.
Sorry.
No, I'm doing this on purpose.
It sounds like what Dan is saying is that our conflicts are not necessarily driven by differing roads to the same goal. They're more driven by I'm right and you're wrong.
If I want my trophy. I participated, I get a trophy. It didn't necessarily that we won, that we being the team, or I won, being the individuals, that we just all got a trophy.
I would say our conflict of disagreement, it's generally not over the district's goals or even strategies or even action items on the agenda to a large part, as evidenced by the fact that we typically the majority vote yes for the action items that make it through the agenda. Mm-hmm. Most of the conflict centers around a very small number of topics or philosophical differences, not necessarily the how we conduct the business of the school.
It's more
it's disproportionate amount of conflict over a smaller number of issues. We agree on most things, I would say.
It's a philosophical and fundamental belief of sometimes just of how school governance should be run.
Okay.
Yeah, school governance is viewed much differently by us as a board. We all here are here for the children, but you know, how school governance goes down, that's a philosophical and fundamental belief. Doesn't mean we're here to hurt the children, it just means different views on that.
So what drives views of school governance? I mean, there are, I've been out of the superintendency for 12 years now, but there's responsibilities that board is supposed to do fiduciary and do policy, and administrators are supposed to do procedures. So are there, can you give me like specifics of what would be philosophically different?
I'm going to tread lightly here. How we communicate the message sometimes.
To the community?
Yes. Okay. I hear out there, I campaigned door to door when I ran. And I heard a lot from a lot of different cross-section of taxpayers, people with kids in the school and people with not kids in the school. And I still hear it today. I'm still hear about it, and I'm surprised. But it seems that our community, some of our community, seems that we have not one community, but a section of a community, like maybe a school community and another community. And we're really one community. We shouldn't be more than that. And I hear it too often. I don't understand why.
Mm-hmm. So I understand, you're telling me that you don't feel the board, as a practice, communicates to all the constituents? Is that philosophically?
That's what I would believe. I believe also that we, you know, a lot of our issues that we stumble on, you know, we need to be consistently transparent and fully accountable. I mean, we have an obligation as elected officials in serving the public to be open and transparent and fully accountable for our actions. And anything less than that diminishes public confidence in our ability to serve as responsible stewards to them.
And I would agree with you, and I would also submit there are issues by law that are not for public consumption and do change how an organization runs, and those are the things that are confidential, and that's one of your core values, they have to remain that way. So are you telling me you believe all those things should be public?
No, executive session. Be like executive session.
Okay, I'm just
oh, of course. Now, we'd be naive. Come on. I mean, and that's another root cause here we have. But that's another story for another day, maybe. There's another issue that we are all facing here. And it's, you know, I don't want to hash it out here now, but it's still not done and over with. So we have, I believe, we're not over that bridge on certain issues yet, on trust issues.
What would you say would be happening if, in fact, you felt you were over it and you were working collectively and you were agreeing philosophically? What would that look like and feel like, and what would I see?
I don't know, because it hasn't happened yet. I'm hoping it would happen soon, but we're not really, I believe we're not cohesive yet because there's still some unanswered questions. And that's all I'm going to say right now.
Thank you for sharing.
You're welcome.
I'm trying to understand because I'm not on meeting.
I understand. Now, and I apologize because I wasn't here last meeting on May 19th. And there was no audio for me to listen to, so I don't know what it went
to. You need to get the notes and you looked at the core values. How do those ring for you as a member?
I like them. And I even added one core value. I don't know. I think in being an excellent board and what I just spoke about, I wrote down continuously convey consistent transparency and full accountability for the common good of our school district and our entire community. I think doing that would also make us excellent. And we can't worry about if, oh my gosh, we're going to get hammered on this or that. We need to be open and transparent. And if we are, we can defend whatever we do. If we're all confident as a board, we can defend whatever we do. Just be open and transparent about it. If we're not, it looks bad.
Can you give an example?
Yeah, I'm going to give an example at the last meeting when we were doing that letter after the fact, and I said that we should have did it. We should have discussed the BA salary during the process or at the time of the resolution. Sadly, we drafted a letter, and I have no disagreement with her salary. Sadly, we drafted a letter after the fact. We should have discussed it at the time or at the process of it, during the process. It just looks like we're playing catch-up, and that's all. And I think we could have been more open about it. And we could easily defend it. I mean, we could easily defend what we did.
But the process for moving business, like hiring an employee at a certain salary, we employ the committee process, where the committee vets the financials, makes a recommendation to the whole board, and then we vote on it.
Right. And at that meeting, we should have, when the resolution was on the table, perhaps we should have openly explained what we're doing or why we're doing. Maybe that would have, I don't know. I'm just giving my opinion, that's all. And again, we can easily justify what happened. It's not the issue here.
I just don't perceive it to be lack of transparency. We discussed it in committee for an extended period of time. The committee made a unanimous recommendation. It appeared on the agenda, and we voted on it. That's how we conduct it.
I guess when you're talking salary and you're talking a high-profile position and spending the taxpayers' money, again, I don't think we did anything wrong with the salary. That's not the issue. But I think at the time, when we make a resolution, we talk about stuff at the time of resolution. We should have talked about it there. It couldn't have hurt us. Let's put it that way. It couldn't have hurt us.
I agree. And to that point, anytime there is a resolution, there's a period for comment. No comment was given, but the nine of us have the opportunity to comment. Did we fail?
Yeah. But again, you're right.
Did we fail?
We should have. You're right.
I happen to think the process worked well. I guess what I'm getting at is, following up on the video we just saw, were you afraid to speak up if you had reservations?
No, I'm not afraid to speak up. I think that's pretty clear.
No, I understand that. But, and I'm not picking on you.
No, absolutely not. Absolutely not.
But you didn't speak up.
No, I didn't.
That's what we're getting at.
You know what? And maybe I should apologize as a board member. One board member, maybe I should have. I apologize.
No, I don't want you to apologize.
I don't know. I should have.
I'm not seeing you apologize. And you know what? What I'm saying is, following up on what we were just looking at, the video we were just looking at, it's a good example. Were you afraid of and I'm not asking you to answer, were you afraid of a conflict? Were we not thinking about conflict as creative?
Maybe we as a board were afraid. I don't know. I shouldn't speak for the board.
No.
I'm not afraid to speak up. I know that much. And I'm not saying anybody else isn't here, but
I agree. Your point of clarification to me illustrates very carefully what the speaker on the TED website, which by the way is a fantastic website, what the TED website brings up. There may have been some fear of conflict for fear of conflict's sake, whereas we have to learn that conflict is creative, conflict can be collaborative, and conflict can be constructive. I think that's something we should take
to heart. Are you confusing issues? Because the discussion to arrive at a decision or a conclusion as to what the salary should be, which took place, wasn't it at Spruce Run School? Were we there? Or no, we were at the Round Valley. I thought it was a pretty good and detailed discussion in there.
I think Mark's point was that perhaps in light, it might have been better in Mark's opinion to more openly discuss as the motion was moved before it was voted upon.
But I'm not sensing disagreement from the discussion that took place when we voted.
Well, no, is it unanimous?
Oh, no, absolutely not.
What I hear more of is Monday morning quarterback.
Yes. Well, right. We dropped the ball, in my opinion.
We didn't drop the ball.
Well, it's my opinion. I'm entitled to my opinion. I believe at the time we should have said something.
I don't feel that we dropped the ball, because you drop a ball when you're aware of what the play is. And I don't think anyone in the board felt there was a need to be at the public session to go into deep discussion in regards to a salary. After the fact, there have been questions in regards to that, and the board answered them. I think the board did the right thing in coming back and then answering those questions. I don't think that the board would, on every salary, anticipate that we're going to be in a heavy discussion where we're going to look at the geographical constraints, the requirements for positions. We're going to share with the public what every salary in the county or the nation is that allows you to come up with a particular salary. Individuals became upset at that salary setting, and we then went back and explained that. I think that's an appropriate action. So I don't think that we avoided conflict at that session, because I challenge anyone here, did anyone feel that they should challenge that motion or challenge and explain more at that time? I think the answer is negative on that.
I don't think it was a fear of anything. I just think that when you're in a high-profile position as that was, it just would have been helpful to explain. That's all. It couldn't have hurt.
Morning quarterback. So I think the board takes from that is that we learn something from that.
Again,
we do the next one, and we'll have a little more detailed discussion in there.
Right,
I don't think that'll be a conflict.
Right.
But again, that's not avoidance of the situation or dropping the ball. There's a need by a specialized group of citizens that want to see data, some data that we would not normally provide. And I don't believe the board in the past has provided that, and I don't believe that other boards normally provide that data either. So dropping the ball would mean is that you have an established play or an established procedure or an established policy that you follow, and the board did not follow it in this case. And I would just state that as a member who discussed it and came to agreement on what that salary should be, and I had my reservations on how we got there, they're answered well, I would not anticipate doing that in a public environment nor a private environment to explain the full scope of how you arrive at particular compensation. That is not a normal private or public practice.
Nobody disagrees on the salary, obviously. We all voted on it. But I'm just saying consistent transparency. It's all about transparency. And being open and transparent, it could never hurt you.
Wasn't transparent in there.
Yeah, we were transparent.
Right. I just felt listen, this is just my opinion. That's all I'm saying. Just my opinion. I believe at that time Kevin, you're right. I dropped the ball too. I didn't say anything. And normally I do say stuff like.
Did you think something to say then, not after the fact?
You know, I was just excited that we saved a few dollars. No offense. No offense. I was just excited that we saved a few dollars. So I was a little giddy over that. In hindsight, you're right.
So we didn't have a conflict, we didn't have a disagreement.
No, but we learned a valuable lesson, and we continue to stumble over our own feet on stuff like this.
I think when the questions were raised, I think Dan's correct. I think we went above and beyond to exhibit a remarkable amount of transparency, going so far as to produce a PowerPoint report illustrating our decision-making process on something that, quite frankly, we're elected to be entrusted with.
Yeah. It's actually on your website. I read it today and went, oh, my word. A lot of energy, here's my opinion, a lot of energy went into explaining something that typically is under the board's jurisdiction. And I think that there's always a balancing act, and I understand that you represent constituents, but if you want...
That's like the entire community.
If you want your administrative staff spending time, you might as well hire a writer, because
because every issue that you do would require that. But I was just really surprised. Beautifully done, by the way.
Hope from board members.
as far as content, but I thought, okay, I see this one coming. And it was, that was a lot, and not typical.
The argument could even be made that we dropped the ball in so doing. Have we set a precedent where every single time an administrator is brought on, we now have to pull all this data?
Well, I think we have the data. I mean, that was the genesis and the foundation for our decision.
But Pam's right, and I agree. This is something that we are entrusted with within our charter. Mm-hmm. I think we showed an extraordinary amount of transparency and clarity. Mm-hmm. And my concern is now that we have to exhibit to mollify that specialized group of citizens who are going to raise these questions relative to the Monday morning quarterbacking issue.
Part of why you're
going forward,
where you're elected, I'm appointed. I'm not elected.
Well, I'm appointed as well.
So as electees, the citizenry has basically said we have confidence in you to make these decisions for us. If they didn't have confidence in us, then what we could do is have community meetings, bring together the 14,000 residents of Clinton Township, and have them all vote in a meeting. We're not needed. But the fact is that the citizenry has said, for certain positions within this environment, council, board of education, board, high school, etc., we're going to elect people to do that for us. So if they want to come to every meeting, you don't need boards. Then you just need to bring all the citizens together. So in a lot of these, the citizens are saying, you exercise fiduciary responsibility, you as members of this board, for us. We don't want to do every single detail. Because if we do every detail and every decision that we made, our meetings are going to be a week long, 24 hours a day. There's an awful lot that's in there that needs to be done. And I would say this is an exception. And I agree with you on, have we set a precedence? And is that something that we should be, or any board should be, considering? And I'd ask you, as someone who consults with boards, have you seen any other board go to that level to explain a financial transaction?
Not to that degree. But I also haven't been in it since the day of Yelp and Twitter and tweet and text and da, 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 da. And so that so much is out there. And I think that has changed the dynamics. But what I'm finding really good in this discussion, believe it or not, is that one of the things we don't have time to do as a board is reflection.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And maybe you might want to consider, if you work it in your board agenda, that after you get through your agenda, to really pause for 5 minutes and just say, and just reflect on how you did. In other words, this went well, we moved this business, I'm concerned. Somebody could be it's just a thought to reflect as to what happened. And there was a good conversation. You were talking about transparency. Kevin heard you. You expressed. But you looked at that. Now you know, Mark, next time, I'll say something. Or next time, we might want to give a paragraph in the meeting instead of a PowerPoint and a letter on your web page. So that if you had that little reflective discussion at the end of your meetings, or you could reflect at the beginning of your meeting about your last meeting for a few minutes, because then you're wide awake, because if your meetings are late, you're tired. But reflection is an element we're missing in our world, and we desperately need it, because I think I heard something that could easily have handled without all the law, if I heard it. Just a paragraph, here's the committee process we use, we vetted it, blah, 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 verbally, that's it. It may not have tempered the group, but you will have been transparent.
Many times when the committee heads speak, they talk about what we talked about in committee. There's a couple of times we'll talk about, we talk about this in committee, and this is now we're talking about it out in the public. So,
Michelle, didn't you give updates almost on a monthly basis since last November on where we were at the process and how we were
on the BA search?
Yes,
we discussed it repeatedly, what we were doing as far as. We did searches through the various newspapers, et cetera, to get resumes. We collected resumes. Who was reviewing the resumes?
The trouble we were having.
Sorry.
Why the process was so lengthy?
Right. I mean, we worked on the process for a long time, and there were several searches and there were several go arounds to find the candidate. So
can we add that bullet to the core value or no?
It's up to your.
As a sign of excellence or commitment to excellence, or nobody thinks it's a good idea. continuously convey consistent transparency and full accountability for the common good of our school district and our entire community.
I guess my problem with that is that's hard to define. You know, your version of transparency, my version of transparency.
It apparently doesn't jive.
Not the same.
All right, no problem. No problem at all. No problem. Again, I wasn't here on the 19th, and there was no audio for me to listen to, so I couldn't digest all this. And I took a look at it, and I said, well, what can I add, or, you know, what did I think about it? And I've never met you. I've never, you know, so I'm sort of behind the eight ball here. And,
So are there any other elements in the core values that speak to the issue of transparency, or is there another definition for transparency? Can we dial it back?
I like integrity.
Pardon me?
I like integrity.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I think that's saying the same things using different words.
If you look under collaboration, be open, yeah, trusting, honest, and timely in our communication. Mm-hmm. Seems to address transparency.
Margaret, do you agree with that?
Okay.
Under collaboration?
Fine.
I mean, we hear frequently that we're not transparent enough, but my suggestion would be the only way we conduct business is in the public meeting. Nothing moves, no money is spent unless a majority of the board votes on it in the public meeting. So if anybody feels that there's an issue that we're discussing or voting on and there hasn't been adequate discussion or transparency, to bring it up and discuss it at the meeting. Like if it's a salary of a person or the process by which we arrived at a decision, that's the venue to ask additional questions or make the information available that you think is appropriate for people to hear before we vote on it. That's it. And if we get past the point and everybody votes and everyone's had an opportunity to discuss and give feedback prior to the meeting, I would say once you vote, and we arrive at a decision as a board, then you should support the decision and not come back and second guess it after the fact. I'm saying anybody. And that's how I think it's the best vehicle for conducting ourselves in a transparent fashion. That's the venue. That's when the public's there. That's when it's recorded. And if anything you feel needs more light, that's the time to shine the light.
And you have opportunity, obviously. Mm-hmm. And your agenda is posted in advance so people know what the topics are. You're following all those practices. We have these lights that go out. Our parent conferences, if nobody moves in 20 minutes, and
yes,
you're sending them away, that's right, it's great. They just lights
energy saving light.
So, you know, I appreciate you took a risk expressing, and we had some feedback, and that's sort of the process you're going to all have to talk about what you're going to do, because you're going to have this. Mm-hmm. But I liked what I heard. You have an opportunity built in the system. If it's on the agenda, you may want to say a little more when it comes to spending money or positions, and isn't that fun? I'm so glad I'm out of that limelight. then that's, you have a system for offering. And then once you make a decision, you're going out together.
Or if we can discuss, you know, to stick to the PA example, we can discuss at that time the process, you know, by which we arrived at the selection.
Sure.
There's an HR component to that with the searches that we did in the interviews, which I think we did talk about.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Are you the committee chair for that? Will you
yeah.
It should be great. Just give an overview.
And then from the financial perspective, that we did make a recommendation as a facilities and finance committee, and we could talk about what we discussed in the committee and the considerations we had before, you know, recommending the salary.
I mean, it went down 9-0. It wasn't an issue of any problem, you know, with securing the vote.
I think Kevin's echoing your openness and willingness, and that you could add a little more through the committee chair. That's a great idea. Realities of change. So I'd love to hear what your three things are that you have to know or do to be successful in your work. Just share them with the person next to you first. Just share. Talk to the person.
There you go.
No, you have to change here.
That's right.
I'll move in the middle.
I'll go this way.
Yeah.
Well, with my line of people are throwing things off the wall, walking around, talking about probably can't understand the situation.
And I have to demonstrate leadership. That's the topic. You know, there's a whole bunch of other ways to talk. These are the key ones I've got. Communication, leadership, and coaching.
Leadership and what?
Coaching.
Okay. What do we got? Okay.
Listen. Have a plan. And work hard.
Okay. Kevin.
Mine aren't one word.
Good. Always one.
He's a
I'll try and boil it down.
Okay.
I'll say comprehension. Strategy development and writing.
And what?
Writing.
Writing, okay.
Mine are organization, prioritize, and listen.
Hold on.
Can we vote on yours?
Okay. Organization, prioritize, and listen.
My job, I have a job that I actually get paid for. I didn't work for like 5 or 6 years. Uh-huh. So now I have a job that I get paid for. Mm-hmm. And to me, it's a very, very important job.
And it looks that way.
One of the most important things is I have to be on time.
Okay.
I have to be on time to my job. Uh-huh. And I have to be flexible. And I have to be creative.
Are you in retail?
No, I give out food for people from Nails on Wheels. I help prepare the food.
That's good. Yeah.
When you need to have a driver.
Well, driver one of them is communication.
Okay, it's up there. For
I also put knowledge of student learning.
Okay, so that's your three, right? No, you didn't give me three. That's two.
Right. Okay. I'm looking for something that well, I actually put budget analysis.
Goodbye. So long.
Every day.
There's a lot of overlap, but three of mine were proactive. Communicate, we said already.
We
yeah. No substance and build and maintain relationships.
Okay. Work.
Commitment to excellence, team player, and understanding.
Mine are all been taken.
All of them are taken?
Yeah.
So tell me what they are. They're just curious.
Listen, organize, and I had talk to facilitate, which is all those categories.
Okay.
Again, I think mine are taken by this point, but I had communicate effectively, make key decisions, and manage teams of disparate skill sets towards a common objective, which is probably a little bit much. So we can boil that down to another word. I think leadership or facilitation is probably accurate.
Okay.
We have leadership number two up there.
We have it, okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so we've got 24. Some of them may overlap. What do you think? Or do you think people need these things to be successful? Obviously you do. But you probably buy that you many of those would fit into your work too if you could add them on. Okay, here's my $24,000 question. Do you teach these in Clinton Township schools to your students?
Well, we teach communication, verbal and written. We do listening, planning,
comprehension,
writing, organization, prioritizing, I hope we teach creativity. Yes, we do.
Teach to build and maintain relationships.
Yes.
To listen.
Team player, certainly in physical education and other areas of instruction, understanding.
That's pretty, that's a great job.
An organization.
Mm-hmm.
Having a track of assignments and homework.
Yeah.
That's a great job. So when you, is there anything in there that you see that you think, oh, maybe we might want to, and it's not you to do it as a board, but just to, is looking at the big picture, that telescope lens?
Well, I think we could be, I think we could be stronger in areas like strategy development, right? I think we've done some of that recently, but if you think about, you know, test taking, right, as a particular skill that we have to learn throughout life because we're always taking a test of some sort or another, there's a strategy that goes with that, right? How much of that? I don't know that we're doing in any depth, right? Really, this knowledge of student learning is a big issue for kids to know about themselves.
Metacognition, right. So this, if you buy that you are successful people and you represent a microcosm of our world, or your world, then you want to pay attention to, are we in fact proactively teaching these? And I will give you my very favorite that I use every day on purpose, that I was talking to you about before. And I think it is so important now, because as I said, we live in the texting, twittering, millisecond, make a decision, no time to think about it, we want an answer now, and what are the ramifications of that? When does somebody slow down and say, wait? And how do you play back, I love these sports analogies, and I'm not how do you play back the tapes? Just like you did tonight, you played back a tape of a meeting and what you might do going forward. And I think that's a skill we purposely have to teach ourselves and teach children. And that's my soapbox. Okay.
See, the other is when you look at this and you say, do school systems, I don't think it's just Clinton Township schools, apply this. I think the answer to that question is yes. The question becomes not, does the school systems apply it? Is it effective? And I would be on the other side of the equation saying, no, it's not.
Okay.
On time, for example,
give you real-life examples, millennials. Are millennials on time? No. And we're seeing this as we just brought in for a firm as the first group of leaders from two scopes, interns and also new employees hired straight out of college. They have a little bit of a challenge on understanding time. They have a little bit of a challenge on understanding teamwork. Do they play in a team? Yes. But do they understand teamwork from the perspective of achieving a goal? When you look at building relationships from disparate organizations or multiple constituencies of interest, is it, are they able to deal in that environment? And I don't think the school systems, well beyond K through 8, really teach that and employ that. And the reason I say that is I once managed a $30 million budget, yearly budget, for education. And that's for corporate education to get people up to speed. So is the school system today doing what it's designed to do? I think the answer is yes. Is the end result what benefits the business or work community? There's a huge gap yet.
Right, and you're so good for my transition. because I think I'm going to transition to where you were going. I'm going to do this. Have you seen this of Sir Ken Robinson on the changing educational paradigm? Oh, man, you're going to want me to send this to you. Okay, let's see if I can get back to the slides. This is powerful stuff, especially for us in New Jersey. Very nice. Sir Ken Robinson, if you haven't crossed his path, he is brilliant. Is this going to do this for you?
I didn't watch
it. Okay. Our motto is find a way or make a way. Just let me copy it. I'll go back.
Yeah, it's a different copy that one.
Okay. Copy.
Every country on earth at the moment is reforming public education. There are two reasons for it. The first of them is economic. People are trying to work out how do we educate our children to take their place in the economies of the 21st century. How do we do that, given that we can't anticipate what the economy will look like at the end of next week, as the recent turmoil is demonstrating? How do we do that? The second, though, is cultural. Every country on earth is trying to figure out how do we educate our children so they have a sense of cultural identity and so that we can pass on the cultural genes of our communities while being part of the process of globalization. How do we square that circle? The problem is they're trying to meet the future by doing what they did in the past. And on the way, they're alienating millions of kids who don't see any purpose in going to school. When we went to school, we were kept there with a story, which was if you worked hard and did well and got a college degree, you would have a job. Our kids don't believe that. And they're right not to, by the way. You're better having a degree than not, but it's not a guarantee anymore. And particularly not if the route to it marginalizes most of the things that you think are important about yourself. Some people say we have to raise standards if this is a breakthrough. You know, like, really, yes, we should. Why would you lower them? You know, I haven't come across an argument that persuades me of lowering them. But raising them, of course we should raise them. The problem is that the current system of education was designed and conceived and structured for a different age. It was conceived in the intellectual culture of the Enlightenment. And in the economic circumstances of the Industrial Revolution. Before the middle of the 19th century, there were no systems of public education. Not really. I mean, you could get educated by Jesuits, you know, if you had the money. But public education, paid for from taxation, compulsory to everybody and free at the point of delivery, that was a revolutionary idea. And many people objected to it. They said it's not possible for many street kids, working class children, to benefit from public education. They're incapable of learning to read and write, and why are we spending time on this? So there's also built into it a whole series of assumptions about social structure and capacity. It was driven by an economic imperative of the time, but running right through it was an intellectual model of the mind, which was essentially the Enlightenment view of intelligence, that real intelligence consists in the capacity for a certain type of deductive reasoning and a knowledge of the classics originally, what we come to think of as academic ability. And this is deep in the gene pool of public education, that there are really two types of people, academic and non-academic, smart people and non-smart people. And the consequence of that is that many brilliant people think they're not, because they've been judged against this particular view of the mind. So we have twin pillars, economic and intellectual. And my view is that this model has caused chaos in many people's lives. It's been great for some. There have been people who have benefited wonderfully from it. But most people have not. Instead, they suffered this. This is the modern epidemic, and it's as misplaced, and it's as fictitious. This is the plague of ADHD. Now, this is a map of the incidence of ADHD in America, or prescriptions for ADHD. Don't mistake me here. I don't mean to say there is no such thing as attention deficit disorder. I'm not qualified to say if there is such a thing. I know that a great majority of psychologists and pediatricians think there is such a thing. But it's still a matter of debate. What I do know for a fact is it's not an epidemic. These kids are being medicated as routinely as we have our tonsils taken out. And on the same whimsical basis, and for the same reason, medical fashion. Our children are living in the most intensely stimulating period in the history of the earth. They're being besieged with information and calls for their attention from every platform, computers, from iPhones, from advertising holdings, from hundreds of television channels. And we're penalizing them now for getting distracted. From what? Boring stuff at school, for the most part. It seems to me, not a coincidence totally, that the incidence of ADHD has risen in parallel with the growth of standardized testing. Now, these kids are being given Ritalin and Adderall and all manner of things, often quite dangerous drugs, to get them focused and calm them down. But according to this, attention deficit disorder increases as you travel east across the country. People start losing interest in Oklahoma. Can hardly think straight in Arkansas, and by the time they get to Washington, they've lost it completely. And there are separate reasons for that, I believe. It's a fictitious epidemic. If you think of it, the arts, and I don't say this exclusively the arts, I think it's also true of science and of maths, but I say about the arts particularly because they are the victims of this mentality currently, particularly. The arts especially address the idea of aesthetic experience. An aesthetic experience is one in which your senses are operating at their peak, when you're present in the current moment, when you're resonating with the excitement of this thing that you're experiencing, when you are fully alive. An anesthetic is when you shut your senses off and deaden yourself to what's happening. And a lot of these drugs are that. We're getting our children through education by anesthetizing them. And I think we should be doing the exact opposite. We shouldn't be putting them asleep. We should be waking them up to what they have inside of themselves. But the model we have is this. I believe we have a system of education that is modeled on the interests of industrialism and in the image of it. I'll give you a couple of examples. Schools are still pretty much organized on factory lines, ringing bells, separate facilities, specialized into separate subjects. We still educate children by batches. You know, we put them through the system by age group. Why do we do that? You know, why is has there this assumption that the most important thing kids have in common is how old they are. You know, it's like the most important thing about them is their date of manufacture. Well, I know kids who are much better than other kids of the same age in different disciplines, you know, or at different times of the day, or better in smaller groups than in large groups, or sometimes they want to be on their own. If you're interested in the model of learning, you don't start from this production line mentality. It's essentially about conformity, and increasingly it's about that as you look at the growth of standardized testing and standardized curricula. And it's about standardization. I believe we've got to go in the exact opposite direction. That's what I mean about changing the paradigm. There was a great study done recently of divergent thinking, published a couple of years ago. Divergent thinking isn't the same thing as creativity. I define creativity as the process of having original ideas that have value. Divergent thinking isn't a synonym, but it's an essential capacity for creativity. It's the ability to see lots of possible answers to a question, lots of possible ways of interpreting a question, to think what Edward de Bono would probably call laterally, to think not just in linear or convergent ways, to see multiple answers, not one. So, I mean, there are tests for this. I mean, one kind of cod example would be people might be asked to say, how many uses can you think of for a paperclip? Quite those routine questions. Most people might come up with 10 or 50. People who are good at this might come up with 200. And they do that by saying, well, could the paperclip be 200 foot tall and be made out of foam rubber? You know, like, does it have to be a paperclip as we know it, Jim? You know. Now, they tested this, and they gave them to 1,500 people. This is in a book called Breakpoint and Beyond. And on the protocol of the test, if you scored above a certain level, you'd be considered to be a genius at divergent thinking. Okay? So my question to you is, what percentage of the people tested, of the 1,500, scored at genius level for divergent thinking? Now, you need to know one more thing about them. These were kindergarten children. So what do you think? What percentage at genius level? 98%. Now, the thing about this was it was a longitudinal study. So they retested the same children 5 years later, ages of 8 to 10. What do you think? 15? They retested them again 5 years later, ages 13 to 15. You can see a trend here. Now, this tells an interesting story, because you could have imagined it going the other way, couldn't you? You start off not being very good, but you get better as you get older. But this shows two things. One is we all have this capacity, and two, it mostly deteriorates. Now, a lot of things have happened to these kids as they've grown up, a lot. But one of the most important things out to them, I'm convinced, is that by now they've become educated. You know, they've spent 10 years at school being told there's one answer, it's at the back. And don't look. And don't copy, because that's cheating. I mean, outside schools, that's called collaboration. No, but inside schools. Now, this isn't because teachers want it this way. It's just because it happens that way. It's because it's in the gene pool of education. We have to think differently about human capacity. We have to get over this old conception of academic, non-academic, abstract, theoretical, vocational, and see it for what it is, a myth. Secondly, we have to recognize that most great learning happens in groups. The collaboration is the stuff of growth. If we atomize people and separate them and judge them separately, we form a kind of disjunction between them and their natural learning environment. And thirdly, it's crucially about the culture of our institutions, the habits of the institution, and the habitats that they occupy.
Do we have to do something if we're going to take a break?
You have to stand up. You take 20 minutes.
Do we have to go out of public?
Do we have to adjourn?
Oh, would you adjourn now?
Do we have to? So?
I think we should adjourn for a moment.
Yeah.
5 minutes.
Okay.
entertain a motion that we take a break.
Motion.
Second.
Motion by Dan, seconded by Maria. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? We are now on a 5-minute break.